Coming up on today's episode, the SLS suffers a setback, Starliner is on the pad, maybe up by the time you're listening to this, and Tesla stock goes to the stratosphere, just like Rocket would, so let's get ludicrous. Hi, and welcome to Our Ludicrous Future. This is the podcast where we talk about all the cool future stuff that's going to make tomorrow totally ludicrous.
What is happening?
They told me I needed to get the energy up, so there you go. I'm Joe Scott with the Answers with Joe YouTube channel. With me is Tim Dodd.
Well, you were, like, falling asleep by the end of your intro, like, oh, let's get ludicrous. Oh, yeah, hey, I'm Tim Dodd, the Everyday Astronaut. I am ready for a nap, but maybe Joe is too. And with us is Ben Solens.
What's up, guys? Tim, you have no excuse to be ready for a nap. I'm sorry. You just can't do it. It's not allowed. You need to keep that energy going up into the stratosphere.
You know what? I'm a power napper. Almost every day, I'll take about another 20 to 30 minute nap.
Yeah. Okay. Have you read Daniel Pink's book called When about this whole thing?
Mm-mm.
It's okay. So Daniel Pink, great author, business author, whatever. There's a whole section of, science called chronobiology, where they're studying what time, morning person versus night person, that kind of a thing, and sleep does to your performance. And it's fascinating. But the power nap is totally legit. And the thing he does, which I don't know if you've tried it, is called the coffee nap, where you take like an espresso or like a very strong small bit of coffee, you pound that, and then you go to sleep, because it takes about 20 minutes for it to kick in, and then when you wake up, you're like you're on even more fire than if you just had the power nap.
Everyone makes fun of me because literally I don't know if it's when I drink a cappuccino I just fall asleep like instantly. Yeah. I don't know if it's like the warm milk or something. I'll nap. I always take like a cap nap, I call them. And then, then I like wake up and that's just.
Dude, 100% legit. Weird. The one thing that he said that was interesting, he said, don't go beyond, don't go beyond 20 minutes. Cause he said it's like 7 minutes on average for people to fall asleep. So set your timer for 27 minutes, because beyond 20 minutes, you get into what he called,
like,
sleep inertia,
sleep cycles,
where your body feels like it's going to sleep for a long period of time. So instead of waking up refreshed, you wake up groggy. So
I read about that coffee and sleep both do something. I'm not getting this right, but there's like some proteins that sort of accumulate in your nerves and your brain that both sleep and coffee kind of clear out. So. Mm. Combining them does give you like double the effect kind of thing, and makes you feel more awake.
Yeah, so definitely a good book. I've only listened to his interviews, 10 times where he talked about it. So, but it's on my list to read because that guy is a genius.
Mm-hmm. Sweet. Noted. Yeah. Now I
noted.
Know.
So I want to hear about the workout with the retirees that you're doing.
Well, I decided I've just been porking it too much lately. You know, it's just time to try to become Ben Sullen swole. I think we can all aspire to be that.
Many will try. Few will succeed.
No, my brother-in-law owns, and Jacob Pauli, who used to do the some stuff with, we'd call him Uncle Dad on the show. He used to like play Kerbal with me on the show. They both own a ninja gym together. And because my brother-in-law is a
ninja,
semi-professional ninja athlete. I don't know what you call it these days, but he's been on American Ninja Warrior, as we've talked about on the show. And so he has this awesome gym, and I like never go and work out there, even though it's really close to me. But they have this they have classes, and I don't want to just like show up and like hang on like two rings and then fall off and be like, okay, I'm done. So they do have like classes where you just get like a regular good old workout in, and it's normally at like 5 a.m. and I'm like, so they have one that's 10 a.m., but that's for 55 plus, but I snuck myself into that one. So I just bring my AARP card and I'm ready to go.
It's good to feel good about yourself, right? So to put yourself, I mean, I hope, although I know some 50 plus year olds that are pretty... that are still
Let me tell you this. My mom is one of those people, and she kicks my butt. Yeah. Dead serious. Like 100%. She is way more in shape and athletic than I am. And my dad, nice. He's still recovering, you know, from his heart surgery, so he's not out there shredding right now, but normally he's the same way.
Dang.
Yeah, I know. I'm the lazy one in the Dodd family.
So do y'all know who Kumail Nanjiani is? The guy from Silicon Valley?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see his transformation?
Was that real?
It's real.
I saw his Pornhub thing that they tweeted. Did you see that?
No.
It was hilarious. I just saw his tweet, his response to them. They were like, we changed our thumbnail for the muscular men category. And it was a photo of him.
Oh, funny. They,
that's funny.
So good.
Yeah. No, he's in some Marvel movie. So they had to get him all buffed out. And here, I'll share the screen real quick.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, that's... that's a real picture. I mean, it looked Photoshop when I first saw it.
I thought it was Photoshop. It looked like something that
he would have just done and put up there, but...
no way. Yeah,
what I really like, though, I just have to shout him out real quick. On his Instagram post where he shared that, he made this big point of calling out that, like, he's 41 years old, and he said, I've never looked like this before, and now that I look like this, I know why I never looked like this before, because he has a whole team of trainers and nutritionists and dietitians and a whole studio with billions of dollars paying for it. And he did this for a year to get to where he is right now.
Wow.
And I thought that was really cool because a lot of people, you know, when they transform themselves, they're like, oh, look how awesome I am. And he was like, no, right. No.
Right.
This was right. A lot of work by a lot of people, and it wasn't just me. And it took a lot of money, and most people can't do this, which I thought was refreshing.
Yeah, that is refreshing. Because that's the whole thing. We're so... yeah. Anyway, should we probably get on to some space news? Because there was a lot of it since I've been gone since last week. You only got a Why Don't They Just With Me from
speaking of getting jacked, let's talk about
Peter Beck of Rocket Lab. So as you guys remember, last week I was gone because I was sitting, literally while you guys were recording, I was sitting on a new launch pad with the CEO of CEO of Rocket Lab, and his name is Peter Beck. Who is, I have to say on the record, genuinely, I think he's one of my absolute favorite people in the space industry. He's just like the most chill guy. You know, you've talked to him, Joe.
You know what's funny is like, I was watching your interview with him and I was like, oh man, he got to interview Peter Beck. And I was like, wait, so did I.
Wait,
like a long time ago. And then I was like, Peter Beck's an awesome guy. Like, I'm nobody. Why was he talking to me?
No, you're not a nobody, but
I was definitely nobody
Peter...
back then.
Well, look at you now. So we have a lot to share, even just with Rocket Lab. So they opened up this brand new launch site. Sorry, I'm just like scrolling through their Twitter feed. Here it is. Brand new launch site. This is out at Wallops, and Wallops is it's in Virginia. It's just about, you know, it's about a 3 or 4 hour drive, 3.5 hour drive from DC. You kind of have to go around. But there's only really two other launch pads out there that are at all active. The one's pretty active, and that's the Antares launch pad is there. And that's one of the rockets that supplies the International Space Station with cargo for the Northrop Grumman and their Cygnus capsule. Launches literally right next door to this. Like, you can't miss it. The two pads are like literally not even 100 meters apart, I think. They're super, super close. But,
sounds,
you know,
safe.
Of course, what was that?
Sounds safe.
Well, unfortunately, I don't know if you remember, the Antares did have a full-blown boom like 3 or 4 years ago, and it did level that pad. Mm. But, yeah, I mean, launch pads. who needs them? Just stick the rocket on the ground and hit go. But so this is really exciting because this will allow them to have this is their second launch pad, and although it only services about the same amount and actually maybe less than their original pad in New Zealand, because the way orbital mechanics work, you can only go like anywhere around the world. You can go up to 90 degrees. You can go like north, straight north, you know, or straight south, depending on, like, that is assuming that you're not flying over land. But physically, you can go into a polar orbit from anywhere around the world. You can only go on an equatorial orbit, like directly around the orbit, without doing some kind of plane change on the equator. So the further north you are, that's actually like your minimum latitude. So Kennedy Space Center is at like, I think it's 28 degrees north. So you can't get on even if you fly due east, like your minimum orbit is 28 degrees at an angle of 28 degrees. Does that make any sense? Sorry if that's like really confusing. But because their other one is on the south side of the Earth, you know, it's on the opposite side, they're both in, on similar inclinations. So it's not like they're gaining any more, you know, they're not opening up like, oh, now we can do equatorial or anything like that. It's just that now they can launch maybe even more secure and more, you know, Air Force type of stuff, Department of Defense for the U.S. military, more classified payloads. The big thing with Rocket Lab is they're ahead of their customers already. They can probably sign papers and put something in space in literally like 6 weeks to 8 weeks now. That's wow. Nuts. So for Department of Defense purposes and national security's sake, it's like really big deal. So I think that's honestly one of the main reasons they have another pad here. But that's not all. Rocket Lab, I just found out like yesterday or... Yeah, look at this. All of a sudden, Rocket Lab... Oh, by the way, we're not done with just two pads. We're building a third pad. So
yeah. That's back in New Zealand, right?
Yep, this is their New Zealand pad. Yeah. So they're building Launch Complex 3 right next to Launch Complex 1 out on the Mahia Peninsula, which makes sense. You already have all the propellant farms and all the tanks and stuff out there. You know, it totally makes sense to just build another, you know, have another way to be able to basically have that little crawler thing turn a corner or whatever. I don't quite know how it's going to work, but it makes sense. I'm sure there's a lot of infrastructure they can share, including ground tracking stations, things like that. And these rockets are so small that, you know, they can just build them, fly them, shoot them off into space, put stuff in space, boom, bing, bang, boom, no big deal. I think we're going to see a lot from Rocket Lab. Like, we're going to get sick of Rocket Lab launches.
They're going to have to be more clever with the names.
I don't know. What are they going to do?
All the other rocket companies like, oh, this is SPC 1320, you know, but Rocket Lab's always like, it's business time or too many words or what, you know, like these.
Yeah,
these
yeah, like running out of fingers. Like, yeah.
I like when they do themes, you know. I don't know if these guys have them at all, but back when I worked in tech, it was always like we'd have a server farm and we would choose Disney characters or something. So we would name each server something. So it wasn't just like, yeah, you know, SC483 or something dumb like that. It was like, oh, that was Bagheera or that was Little John or that was Mowgli or whatever, you know. So
yeah.
Bagheera?
Yeah, he was from Jungle Book. He was the...
Which
one was he?
I forget. I don't know.
I just remember the server name, actually.
That's awesome. So there you go. So Rocket Labs they ended up having a really big 2019, and I think 2020 is just going to be even bigger. I just love that company. They're cool. They're nimble. They're quick. I mean, they built Launch Complex 2 in under a year. So that's amazing. So I wouldn't be surprised if Launch Complex 3 gets built in under a year again. They're just going to knock it out of the park. Super, super cool. So yeah.
It's great to see. Go ahead, Joe.
I'm sorry. Just looking at this picture that's on the screen. Is that a computer rendering or is that like the full?
That's actually, yeah, it is. Yeah. Good. I was like, what is going on?
It's not real.
Yeah.
But I guess they're still working on it.
Yeah, that's just kind of a rough mock-up. It looks like they do have to have additional propellant tanks and things for this secondary pad. I'm surprised they can't share them between the two pads. You'd kind of think there'd be some commonality there, you know, same vehicle and everything. But maybe it's just a matter of, like, it takes a week or two to refill them? I don't know. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it might be more efficient just to have them. Well, how does the fuel get there to begin with?
Yeah. Oxygen you can pull out of the air, obviously, but RP-1 has to be delivered by a truck. But so
what air, though? Our air is like 80% nitrogen. It's not even...
Yeah, you where do you think oxygen comes from? We still pull it from the air, even though it's... You just separate it into pure oxygen, then chill it down to, you know, liquid oxygen, which is actually kind of difficult-ish. So anyway, speaking of launch pads and turning them around quickly, SpaceX launched the other day. Did you guys realize that they had their quickest turnaround, that they had just launched? So on December, 16th, SpaceX launched the JSAT-18 and Pacific One satellites from Launch Complex 40. It was only 11 days after they had just used that launch pad. Which is... Yeah, that
I can't
is
even keep
crazy.
Up, man. It's they launch so frequently. I just see your tweets like going live. I'm like, again?
I'm going to be a busy boy. I'll tell you that.
Like, you're going to have to stop live streaming them all because there's going to be too
already,
many.
It's already a thing. I'm already just kind of having to pick and choose a little bit. I really don't want to live stream more than like once or twice a week because it takes more time than people think. People think you just sit down and blah, but like, I'd say almost for every, you know, every hour you live stream, there's an hour of like preparing and or post processing things and getting stuff ready on the back end when it's done too. So yeah, it's like, I'll never get videos done, even worse than I don't know. But anyway, this was a mission going out to geostationary transfer orbit, pretty heavy satellite, and SpaceX was attempting to catch both fairing halves using Mistree and Mischief, the two fairing catching boats. This is the first time they're trying to actually do them both at the same time. And spoiler alert, they were successful in catching neither of them.
I was going to say, wait a minute.
I was curious.
Now, did they say they weren't going to try, right? Like, it just wasn't even going to happen?
No, they tried.
Oh, okay. Because, again, can't too much going on to try to follow with that detail. But I swear it was like, yep, just not going to happen. Like, they knew early on that they were...
That happened recently where they had to turn the boats back because seas were too rough and they're just like, nope.
That was the previous time they tried to catch both of them, which was just a week before that. Got it.
I think so. Yeah. I know. I'm getting confused too now. It's hard to keep up these days. But the mission was, of course, a huge, huge, huge success. The booster landed dead center, bullseye landing. And most importantly, the payload got deployed and on its way to geostationary transfer orbit. So an absolute knockout, picture-perfect mission for SpaceX. They're really, truly making this look just routine and mundane, which is maybe why our friends at Business Insider had to write this headline.
Uh-oh, here we go.
A SpaceX rocket lost its nose cone during an otherwise successful launch in Florida.
I just can't help themselves.
Do you guys want to pick this apart with me?
Does it have a nose cone? What are they talking about?
They're talking about the fairing.
Oh, because I feel like a nose cone is something different.
Yeah, it kind of is. So that's kind of already false.
So they're talking about the fairings?
They're talking about the fairings.
Which... every company that has ever launched ever loses their fairings every single time they launch?
Yes. And it's actually, it'd be a bigger deal if they didn't lose the fairings. Actually, there's been two missions, like the Agena target vehicle with like Gemini, what was that, 6 or 8 or something. The payload fairing didn't deploy. And it was a failed mission because of that. Or OCO-1, carbon observing on a Delta II, the fairing didn't deploy. So it didn't lose its fairings, and that was a failure. It was a failed mission. And here they're trying to make it sound like it lost its... And actually, the funniest thing is, again, not only is SpaceX the only company trying to recover fairings, they never lost it ever because they literally tracked it the whole way down, which no other company does. They never at one point lost it. They just didn't catch it.
Didn't they get it out of the water, though?
They still fetched it right out of the water. So it's not like it's a thing where they couldn't even find it. You know, they lost it in the ocean and then it waves, you know, succumbed to waves and all of a sudden it sunk to the bottom. Nope. They fished them out of the water, right? Because they only missed it by like a couple meters or whatever.
I'm guessing that a negative headline just simply gets more clicks than an accurate one.
Of course.
So.
Of course.
That's just, to me, that is like, that's so... dangerous. And so, like, how can you think that's fair? Yeah.
You know, I mean, Joe, you're right. Like, if you look at research about this, psychology shows us that negative headlines draw your attention more. And Business Insider is in the business of getting clicks and whatever. So, I mean, this is just a factor of human psychology and the internet, essentially, you know.
Which is why you'll notice I did not link to the article. I just did a screenshot.
Yeah.
Seriously, yeah. I don't want them to get the clicks of a completely horrendously misleading headline. Yeah, has to be intentionally misleading. Mm-hmm. I mean, you wouldn't phrase otherwise successful mission. Makes it sound like the mission was like compromised because it lost its note. Like,
that'd be like. That'd be like Formula One racer loses all four wheels during race, but places first. It's like that. That's called changing your tires. You do that through the race.
Well, and then it was great. Twitter really had some good ones. Like someone goes like, they lost. Two fairings have So Kimi Talviti, I don't know how to say his last name. Sorry, Kimi. Had they caught them, the headline would have been two fairing halves from SpaceX's Falcon 9 rocket fell onto a fully crewed ship on sea. You know, and then someone else goes like, I don't remember, like they lost all their fuel, you know, or whatever. Like SpaceX rocket loses all of its fuel.
SpaceX loses payload in space. What happened to the payload?
Horribly exactly. Inefficient rocket is completely devoid of fuel when it lands.
Or that was the first stage of SpaceX's rocket had to return home after almost running out of fuel. Like,
great.
I love it. Yeah.
You almost want to get ahead of them and just like create your own like
onion
fake
style.
It could be like an onion for negative SpaceX and Tesla news.
Yeah.
Just to get ahead of the actual websites.
It's insane. This is one that I didn't see too many. This could have easily been spun wrong. I don't remember. You guys didn't talk about this last week, right? The hydrogen tank from SLS, right?
So no, we didn't talk about it.
So they did the full pressure test of the whole hydrogen tank of the SLS rocket, and just to test how well it does, and it performed great. It stood there for 5 hours actually at 260% of operating loads. So I just talked about this. I released that video about whether or not Starship should have an abort system. And the margin of safety oftentimes for most aerospace things is about a margin of safety 1.5. So 150% of expected loads. Some things that like don't have heritage or are kind of newer, riskier parts might have a factor of safety of 2. So 200%. So this stood there for 5 hours at 260%. So clearly beyond someone almost argued, you could then make it into a thing of like, well, and it's too strong. It could have made it lighter. But no, this is a good thing. It handled beyond expectations, really, and is an important milestone for the Artemis program for the SLS rocket. Yeah, which...
Okay, can I call out a total douchebag real quick?
Yes.
His name is me, because at the beginning of this podcast, I said SLS suffers a setback, didn't I? And I was talking about this. This wasn't a setback. Oh, this was meant to happen.
No, this was meant to happen. I didn't realize you said it suffers a setback.
I did say that.
Oops. You just Business Insidered us.
I just Business Insidered our own podcast.
How dare you, Joe?
So I will take my penance now. I will drink the flaxseed oil.
Go flog yourself.
Flog myself, yes.
Or vlog yourself. Has anyone ever vlogged flogging?
Yeah. This was funny because doesn't he? Yeah. So Jim says success. I remember when I first saw that, I was like, huh? What?
No. Ooh. This is good.
We did it. We blew it up.
I know. Like, really? I did. Yeah.
But that's why it is important to literally lead with success, because you see this and you immediately just think, "Uh-oh," you know.
He could totally like. Okay, imagine the windows didn't break at the Cybertruck thing. The amount of people talking about Cybertruck would be still a lot, but it would be a lot less, right?
Yeah.
I think he could have played this as like a clickbait thing himself. Like you were saying, get ahead of it and been like, terrible day. Oh my God, what happened? You know, we really need to. Just kidding. Meant to do that. Ha ha ha.
Oh, I just don't quite know if I see the head of NASA quite.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's not really NASA style.
We all live in a clickbait world now, though. You got to embrace it. You know, Hurst to blame.
I wasn't trying to make this into like a shuttle disaster or something. Like I knew that this was part of testing and that this is essentially a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I did use the word setback. So I'm going to take my lumps on that one. I shouldn't have said that. Sorry, guys.
It's okay. No, it's understandable. And it's hard to keep up because there had been so many really negative things happening with SLS, especially like earlier this year. It just seemed like it was bad. And I have to say, major, major credit. I really feel like Bridenstine is whipping Boeing into shape. I honestly think he's starting to, you know, put some flame under their feet or whatever, whatever the phrase is, you know, candle under their butt or whatever
feet
it's called.
Fire.
There you go. No, it's candle under the butt. Trust me. That's what that's
light
what
a fire
says.
Under him.
Yeah. And it just really seems like Boeing has all of a sudden kind of just gone, okay, we got to get on this. Otherwise, we are going to lose everything.
I mean, is everyone just woeful? I mean, so SpaceX is obviously like way ahead of everyone else, right, when it comes to basically all of this stuff. And then Rocket Lab seems to be kicking butt, right? And then who else is there, the major players? ULA and, or no, ULA is not a company, right? It
yeah,
is.
Yeah, ULA is.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Boeing and Northrop Grumman? Northrop Grumman makes like satellites and stuff.
Well,
right?
they also do that Antares launch vehicle.
Yeah. So like, I wonder if those, because they're kind of the old guards at this point, right? They've been mm-hmm. around way longer and stuff. Do you think they're just like the traditional automakers when the Model S first came out going, oh crap, we better get it in gear, otherwise it's just going to be game over. Like, who's going to launch with them if it costs, you know, 10 times as much and takes 10 times as long?
Well, I want to correct you by when you initially Please. Just kind of when you said that SpaceX is way ahead, because honestly, and trust me, you're talking to, I just want to make sure we have a little reality check. I am
Please. Yeah.
Clearly the biggest SpaceX fan. But even when you do compare, you know, we're sitting here seeing SpaceX and Boeing both have the exact same program, the commercial crew program, and Boeing and SpaceX are still to this day, it's a race even to this day to be able to get to the first people up to the International Space Station. You know, Boeing tomorrow, and by the time you guys listen to this, hopefully has already launched their Starliner. That's 9 months after SpaceX launched the DM-1, first Starliner or first Dragon capsule, basically. First Dragon capsule, the crew version without people on it.
Right.
But it's still anyone's race at this point. SpaceX still has to do their in-flight abort. I could see it still being, you know, close March.
So
and
Boeing,
April.
Boeing is still in the game. It's not where it's like, why would anyone ever call them for something, right? They're not completely out of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be people screaming in the comment section. Of course, Boeing got paid a lot more than SpaceX did to do the same service, basically.
Like when was Boeing's last launch of something?
Well, they're part of ULA. They're a parent company of ULA.
Right.
So they have that. They launched the X-37B, that little mini secret spy thing. They make tons of satellites. Uh-huh. I mean, they're a major satellite manufacturer. But as far as an actual vehicle, a launch vehicle, I think the last time Boeing made a launch vehicle was the space shuttle.
Right. So what, 12 years ago is when that, 2000?
2009. It was 2011, so.
2011, yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so. Yeah, I don't know. I guess just when maybe from the outside perspective, you look at it and you just go, man, like Rocket Lab, killing it, right? Like all the time you're hearing all these fun things they're doing. It's like super cool. It's, you know, they're putting stuff up. Even Blue Origin to that extent is like, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about yeah. it last week, even though they're I seemingly just still testing everything, but they're doing stuff. And it just seems like all the old guards that have been here forever are just kind of like, I don't know. It just seems kind of they're kind of lagging behind.
Well, here's, and so now that I've said the like realism part of it,
yeah,
the looking, because that's where we're at now, right? Like
right.
like today, but going forward, I think yes, I think the older manufacturers are really going to have a hard time winning any kind of bids for.
They're
going
to have to step it up, right? They're going to have to really come forward with some so cheaper,
I talked about this.
Yeah,
I think on a live stream I talked about, like, you know, people were like, what's ULA? What are they even, what's the point? And the thing that you do need to remember is ULA, as expensive as they are, easily 2 to 3 times more expensive for a pretty much similar ride compared to, say, a Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy. But when you have a $2 billion satellite and you're looking at a company with literally a perfect track record that will put that $2 billion satellite into space, what's the difference if you're spending $100 million versus $200 million? Like, most people would say, because of their perfect track record, and, you know, especially when it comes to military assets and stuff like that, that speaks volumes. That's worth a tangible, like, an actual ledger amount of money.
Yeah.
to have that reliability. And that will just take time for SpaceX to really have that track record. They're proving it now. They have had an unbelievable successful couple years now, 3 years of just domination. So that's where things will shift. You know, we're seeing that they're becoming reliable enough. Their prices are coming down. Their cadence is picking up. And that's just Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy. Wait until Starship's going. Yeah. And then it's just game over. So
I think that that point you made there about military stuff and just government stuff in general made sense, because in my history working in tech, it was weird. Like, enterprise stuff was always 10 times the price of consumer stuff. Like, mm-hmm. I remember we had a server at this financial firm I was doing consulting at, and we wanted to add like 10 gigabytes of space to a server. 10 gigabytes, right? That's like nothing.
Yeah.
It was going to be like $7,000 for that. Why? Because the server and the stuff itself was like ancient, and so you couldn't even buy the stuff anymore. You had mm-hmm. to find some like manufacturer that would retrofit all the old ones that had been, you know, decommissioned in mm. order to do it. And the only reason we did it that way was because the cost of upgrading that entire thing to, say, like Amazon Cloud or Microsoft Cloud or whatever was way more expensive than just keeping this old system going. Right. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I guess from that standpoint, it makes sense. But from like a new company, like let's say me and you wanted to start a telecom company and we like, you know, got a satellite going, I doubt we're going to be calling up any of those guys from the like commercial side of it, right? So right. It probably makes sense that you're going to have different use cases and different channels here, but it just seems like, I don't know, like I want to see more from them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Joe, what do you think? I mean, you've been paying attention to the whole, you know, old guard versus, you know, the more traditional aerospace entities, and obviously now we're seeing Rocket Lab, Blue Origin, SpaceX. Like, do you think there's room, I guess, going forward for some of those older players if they continue to kind of play the game that's been laid out?
Well, I think what you said is an important one, that, you know, when you have, you know, a James Webb Space Telescope kind of thing, you want to put it in the hands of somebody that has put up the Hubble, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I don't know who exactly put up the Hubble, but you get the point. So there's been disruption in the launch market, but there's also an expanding satellite market. So I think the market will grow to fit the providers that allow it to get up there. Mm-hmm. I just think it's exciting. I don't think Boeing's suffering necessarily. I think they've got their own little niche, and that's probably going to change and adapt mm-hmm. and evolve. But, you know,
I will say, I think Boeing really likes cost plus contracting. And I think that it's obvious that the commercial crew operating under a different set of contracts really kind of made them have to step up the game a little bit. And mm-hmm. it's still slower than any of us would have anticipated, with Boeing and SpaceX both guilty of that. So let's be clear about that. You know, we were hoping to see first people going to the ISS in like 2016 or 2017 originally. So both companies are very far behind, but that's just space, you know. Crew safety is way more important than rushing an arbitrary deadline. So,
word.
So speaking of space and Boeing, and I wanted to show you guys this, and I haven't even been able to actually watch this, and we're going to watch it without the sound on, but we're just going to play. The Artemis program is getting way more serious. Like, it's happening. So to be clear, Artemis, of course, is NASA's plans to get humans back to the moon by 2024, which honestly, at the beginning of this, I'm just laughing going, guys, not again, like not another. We've always been trying to get back to the moon, but and they moved the deadline up from, like, you know, a lot of people were always hearing like 2028, and this was, you know, 3 years ago or something. So to say 2024, when we're only, that's coming up on 4 years away, is very ambitious, right? But now we see, you know, we're seeing the spacesuits come out. We're seeing Orion getting ready. We're seeing SLS literally, you know, coming together. They did a big Artemis Day.
And coming apart.
We're seeing they had a big old fat Artemis Day where Bridenstine stood up and talked for about 45 minutes kind of about the Artemis program. And one of the big things that he said that kind of helped me realize that, okay, I get it more. I can't find it, but
this is what it's like being on Tim's computer. Just endless scrolling of space stuff.
Yeah, for real. But basically, okay, so the Artemis Day thing, I don't have a visual for it, but basically, Brian Stein was down in Michoud, which is where they do the final assembly, and the SLS rocket has the four RS-25 engines assembled, sitting on the big old tank, and he's standing there and he's explaining basically, you know, that this is the safest way we can get people to the moon and on a timeline. And it's I think it's a reasonable timeline with SLS and Orion. Because, again, think about how long it took to get crew on, on Dragon. If we had to start scratch and say crew's going on Starship, it will be, I still think that's 8 years, honestly.
Whoa.
Like, reality check.
Yeah.
I think
Dear Moon?
Okay, maybe not eight, but maybe six or seven. Like, it's a lot further away, I think, than a lot of people think. Just
it's
knowing
like me
how,
and self-driving cars.
It is. And it's because it's hard. It's not because they're wrong about their timelines and wrong about their ambitions. Their ambitions are dead on. Like, that will happen, of course. But there's just things that come up. And Orion's been being developed at its first full, like, basically all-up test flight. It's already flown, like, almost halfway to the moon in 2014. Like, Orion's ready. SLS is pretty much ready, and they ordered enough of them that they can do a handful of missions. And I think it's expensive. The thing that I disagree with is when Brian Stein in that he'll say over and over, we're going back to the moon sustainably. And to me, there's nothing sustainable about a $30 billion project that has gone nowhere that will cost more than $2 billion per flight.
What does he mean sustainably?
So the idea is with the Lunar Gateway being a reusable command module, basically, and having a new Artemis program with commercial partners involved, including potentially some commercial launch services to get crew or pieces of, you know, lunar landers and stuff like that, that it can bring the cost down a lot.
Okay.
But
sustainably from a financial standpoint.
And yeah, just from an architectural standpoint, basically. And he's not... The idea is great, but you're not going to do it sustainably through SLS, period. But maybe to kickstart it, though. And so he kind of almost said it like that. Like, he almost hinted at, like, listen, this will get us there by 2024. It'd be silly for us to not finish this up and, you know, and get it going. And if other options come up, and he basically hinted that, like, there's some big players coming in, and that'd be great. That will put even more fire under everyone's butt. That'll put more fire under Boeing's butt to get SLS going. That'll put more fire under SpaceX to get to get Starship ready, reliable, flying, and going, so that they can take over those contracts. Like, this is a total win-win. This is what we want. And we want, you know, everyone says, why don't we just cancel SLS and put that money somewhere else? Of course, there's some truth to that. Of course. But the problem is, a lot of that money, if you cancel the program, it just goes bye-bye. It doesn't come back. It doesn't get re-earmarked for somewhere else. That's just not really how politics and how NASA funding works, you know?
Well, I imagine their budgets are like typical budgets in companies where if you don't use it, you lose it.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So if we gave you $300 million and you only spent 80...
Right.
Next year, we're only going to give you 80.
Yep. Yep. So, yeah. Speaking of budgets, man, this has been a smooth runner here. NASA's 2020 budget did come out for fiscal year 2020, and it's a 5% increase over last year. But we did lose some funding on science programs, which is always a bummer to me. Including planetary major drops in Earth science.
Don't we know enough about planets already? Come on. We don't need that.
Planets are round.
Astrophysics minus 20%. What?
Yeah. Oh,
now you're killing me.
Well, minus 100% on W1st.
Yeah, I need it. Did that
completely cancel that? That's a satellite.
Yeah.
Oh.
I guess they killed it.
Did they? I need to read up on this. Sorry. This just dropped I think like this morning. I haven't had a chance to read this, but you will see that exploration has gone up 27%. So that's how we're going to actually, so that's literally like Orion and SLS, the Lunar Gateway went up 9%. So that's going to help. So they're putting their money where their mouth is. And this is the money that, you know, some of it would not get redistributed like we'd want it to. So honestly, having it producing, say, the SLS rocket and Orion, although it's not great use of money, I will agree with that. It might be a really good flame to get everyone's like butts going, really.
I was concerned there where it said STEM engagement -100%. I don't know what that means, but that doesn't sound good.
No, they dropped a lot of like educational programs. STEM programs. Yeah. Not a fan of that, but that's honestly, I will go ahead and argue that that's like my job. That's our job as science communicators, as people, is to do some of that outreach that honestly, like, I will always say that it's important for NASA to do that kind of stuff, but like, what kind of impact does that actually have? Like global, like, you know, if it's
future generations,
but a few things in the classroom here and there, is that actually better than,
I don't think it goes to that though. Right.
I think it literally was. No, I think it was.
I think what Tim is saying is, couldn't they just put aside about $1 billion for people like us to do this?
Thank you, Joe. That's what I was getting at. That's what, you know, that's what we need.
I mean, they've got that in their couch cushions. I mean,
yeah, we'll just split it three ways, $333 million each, and then we'll just make some more videos.
Yay!
Problem solved.
I'll get a new monitor.
one nice one.
One new monitor.
One very nice monitor.
But just not, without the stand, though.
Yeah, no stand included.
They can't afford the stand.
Yeah. I actually really want to buy one of those. I don't even know what it's called. The new Apple monitor stand, and just put it in the background. Just the stand. Yeah. Just as like.
No, it's like $14,000, isn't it?
Art Deco.
No, it's $1,000.
Stand is $1,000. Yeah.
Why was I thinking it was 14?
The monitor,
the monitor is 14.
Okay. No, the monitor's five.
Stand is another 1,000.
Where did I get 14 from?
I don't know, Joe.
Tell me.
Two of them? I don't know.
Well, basically, maybe you saw someone's videos. If you buy two of the stands, two of the monitors, and then you also get the anti-glare, you'll end up with, a dual monitor setup would be 14 grand.
You can get there.
You can get there. Yeah, that's how you got there. You're welcome.
Apple is quite skilled at separating you from your money, so I would not doubt that we can have a $14,000 phone set up probably coming in a couple
of
years.
They are the strip club of tech companies.
Just like this, throwing your money.
So good.
So we have one more big space thing that I wanted to touch on this week.
Let's hear it.
And this is a very exciting one. We've kind of briefly mentioned it, but this one I'm very excited for. This is a big step. Starliner is on the pad, and
yeah,
it's
that's awesome.
Literally going to be launching in like 16 hours from right now or something. And
is that it?
Yeah, it's happening very, very soon.
What's it launching on? What's the rocket?
Yep. So that is the Atlas V.
Okay.
So that's a ULA rocket. The Atlas V, it's an N22 configuration. And normally you'll hear Atlas V being like 401 or 5, or sorry, wait, the 401, like 551.
He's just saying numbers.
Yeah. So the way that it goes, the first number denotes how big of a fairing there is. So normally rockets have those fairings or nose cones, as Business Insider called them.
if they'll recover them.
The winning lottery numbers this week are.
What if they lose the nose cone on this rocket? Anyway, this one doesn't have a nose cone, so it actually is denoted as N. It already lost it. Good job, Boeing ULA. You already lost your nose cone. Yeah, so this is an N22, so it's an N for no fairing. It has two solid rocket boosters. Wait, 551. Yeah, and then, two solid rocket boosters and then two RL-10 engines on the upper stage. And this is the first time an Atlas V will launch with the dual RL-10 Centaur. The dual motor Centaur has flown before, but never on an Atlas V. So... Mm-hmm. It's a really exciting mission. This is a great step. This will be docking with the International Space Station, I believe, about the next day. And of course, again, uncrewed test flight for this time. Just like the DM-1 mission that was earlier this year with SpaceX and their Dragon capsule. I have to say, I'm watching, I have a lot of friends down there showing a lot of footage. I was supposed to go down. I have press credentials for it. It just did not work this time of year with all the holiday stuff. And
are they going to have an anti-gravity detection object inside of the thing? So you make sure
not anti-gravity
or a
gravitational measurement device, yeah. Or whatever. I don't know. Maybe Boeing will do something. But they did have I forgot to mention they did have their Astrovan getting ready. I'll show you guys this. So Boeing will be doing basically a new Astrovan. And I don't know if you guys remember, SpaceX has been talking about, I think they're going to be doing Model X's to send the astronauts out to the pad.
My parents had an Astrovan when I was growing up.
I was going to say, they're competing with Dodge now.
Yeah. Apparently. Does it have a wood stripe down the side of it?
No, it's actually, here it is. This is the Astrovan, as they're calling it. And it's pretty cool. It's basically just a giant Airstream.
Gotcha.
It just wrapped an Airstream.
Yeah, it is. It's just a wrapped Airstream. I'm trying to see if there's other pictures. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm just...
much for that STEM engagement budget. There goes the Astrovan.
Hey, they need that unless the... Oh, here we go. Unless they want to make the astronauts walk out to the pad. That'd be pretty funny. Like, okay, guys, you got a 3-mile trek. Have fun.
Come on, you've been training for this.
The suits only weigh 100 pounds.
Oh, this is for the astronauts to ride in. This is literally for the astronauts. Educational type thing.
No. This is what takes what the astronauts will go in to get out to the launch pad. So
when they
pretty cool.
God, I guess it's been so long. When they come back, do they still do a thing where they're like in a quarantine or something?
No, not anymore. That stopped after. The first couple Apollo missions, they had them, only the first, maybe Apollo 11 was like, or maybe the first couple were the only ones that they quarantined them in case there was unknown like bacteria or something on the moon.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, that being said,
Astrovan looks like something you would have a bachelorette party in on the inside.
Let's rent it for something for our ludicrous future from Boeing. But guys, we need this.
Our ludicrous van.
We are going to party in the back of that thing.
Actually, that would be awesome.
It would be sweet. But that is to say, like I said, I'm just honestly genuinely really excited to see the Commercial Crew Program ramping up. It's finally happening. I don't know. Yeah,
do you know
excited.
If they have cargo on it that they're taking up there?
I would assume so. I actually, if only someone
had they're
going like
to connect to the ISS, they might as well bring something.
I'm pretty sure they are.
Mr. Tang.
Shrimp cocktail.
If only there was a website that had like previews on that type of stuff. So the payload mass is 13 tons, 29,000 pounds.
Sounds like a segue to a Squarespace commercial.
I don't actually know if I see anything on our website, everydayastronaut.com/prelaunchpreviews, that talks about additional payloads. I thought I read somewhere about additional payloads, but I'm going to have to brush up on it tonight and really dive into it before I live stream tomorrow. But yeah,
that's exciting though. I'm happy to see it going up.
Yes, it's about time. And this is a big milestone. So fingers crossed that this all goes very well, because this will directly correlate to how quickly we actually get people on it for the CFT mission. So it's still, like I said, I don't remember. I need to dig into this a little more, but I think they have like the next one pretty much ready to go. And, you know, if this goes well, I think it'd be a pretty quick turnaround to be able to get people on it. So I got to figure that out, kind of get a good time frame going. But SpaceX is coming ready for their in-flight abort. It's now moved to January 11th, but still... That's still pretty close. Once that's done, they're hopefully, assuming everything goes well there too, they'll be ready. That'll be their major final checkout besides parachutes. I think both companies are trying to finish their parachute certifications. But
yeah, because that's kind of the next big thing, right? Like, so Rocket Lab is doing reusable, SpaceX obviously, but is anyone else?
You mean for using parachutes to recover?
Any kind of reusability.
Yeah, obviously, Blue Origin, like you said, ULA with their with their Vulcan rocket will be trying to use parachutes to reuse the engine portion of their rocket. So they'll detach the engines, have an inflatable heat shield, and then draw a parachute. But as far as parachutes for this is a different thing. It's just for safety of, you know, bringing the crew home safely, because parachutes are the most reliable form of slowing down. Was that supposed to be a segue?
Why don't they just do that though, Tim? Why doesn't NASA do that?
Are you trying to get me into the why don't they just like this?
I'm just trying to knock all the space stuff out of the way here since we're on such a roll.
Okay, space stuff out of the way.
Why don't they just do this? Why don't they just do that?
Is that what you wanted, Ben? Is that really what you wanted? Did you guys miss that?
Oh my god. Yeah. Yes, we severely missed that.
It just ties the whole podcast together.
God, so stupid.
It's like a good rug.
Okay, this is more a question for you guys. I want to see what you guys think of this. It's a great question. Andrew Nelson at Mr. Pura Vida on Twitter.
Pura Vida.
There you go. Says, what are your thoughts on NASA not interested in propulsive landings for crewed missions? Why don't they just use landing wheels and parachutes on Starship after it does a second reentry burn? Why try to land vertically instead of horizontally? That's basically the big thing, is why not just like fly to a landing, or, you know, use parachutes to just land horizontally instead of trying to do the propulsive landing on Starship? You know how Starship will be doing that crazy thing and landing down on its tail? That seems pretty dangerous and crazy. Why don't they just rip some chutes, land horizontally, or even better, just land like the space shuttle did horizontally? Why don't they just?
Because someone's already done that.
That's why. Someone's done it, therefore it sucks.
Yeah. We want innovation here, okay? We can't do all innovative stuff and copy someone else.
Airplanes land that way. We're not going to do that. We're space.
Stupid.
What do you guys think?
I don't know how that would work any better. First of all, the parachutes have to be gigantic because Starship is gigantic. Like, I don't even know if they make them that big, but maybe they do. That's a side thing. But like, so you got parachutes and it's floating down, and then you have wheels so that it like
it'd have
floats
to be landing
then,
gear, right?
Are we talking like a parasail or something and come down?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe like Gemini style, how Gemini had that Regala wing concept where they were going to throw that out and then land it on wheels. I don't know.
Oh.
Basically, why don't they do anything but propulsive landing? We'll go there. Why, you know, why not use parachutes? Why not use bigger wings maybe and land it horizontally?
Well, I can't help but wonder how many people were asking the same question before they said they were going to land Falcon 9s when that seemed impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming they've worked it out and they think they can make it work, and it's probably more sustainable and reusable, and they're using I imagine it would be easier to do that than to like redo the parachute thing. I'm sure that's a whole ordeal, probably more so than we think. But
why doesn't LeBron do a layup instead of a dunk? I mean, because the dunk is awesome. That's why. There's a clear answer here, obviously.
But that's a better answer.
So I think my favorite answer to this is actually, Elon said it a couple times, there are no runways on Mars. There's no runway on the moon. To land on the moon, to land on the Mars, on
not
the Mars.
Now.
True. But you have to, well, and on the moon, you can't use parachutes. You can't glide to a, there's no air.
Because there's no, you, yeah. There's no atmosphere.
You have
right?
to land propulsively on the moon, and realistically, you have to land propulsively. No, you have to land propulsively for a vehicle of this size on Mars. We already have to land propulsively, basically with Curiosity, you know. And are that they, vehicle's only, you know, a hundredth or 2,000th the size or whatever it is. I don't know. It's way smaller than Starship, and they already outgrew parachutes for that.
You'd need like an Astrodome size parachute for Starship, right?
At some point you're lugging more parachute than you're lugging payload, you know.
Well, speaking of Curiosity, I was just thinking before you said that maybe they could do sort of a hybrid crane technique kind of thing like Curiosity did, but use parachutes to float it down and then just kind of use some propulsion to like stick the landing at the end or something.
Yeah, but now you're talking, like, that sounds way more complicated than just using the engines that are already there. Way lighter, because you don't have to worry about parachutes, the supporting structure of parachutes. You don't have to worry about additional thrusters that are horizontally mounted as opposed to the engines that are already built into the vehicle. Yeah. And it's just a matter of, like, once you engineer around these things, they become, you can handle it. Like, you know, again, propulsive landing of Falcon 9 seemed literally impossible. And now they're making it look so easy, and they're still trying to, you know, they're still pushing it to the boundary sometimes, but for a routine mission, you know, and especially if they add more redundancy, like that CRS-16 where the grid fins were stuck, that happened because it's not mission critical, and it's definitely not human life critical to land for the Falcon 9. If they designed it around mission criticality and all that stuff, I think they'd be to the point where they're basically 100% now, you know, or very, very safe. But yeah, that's, I think the main reason is just like, it does not scale well to do parachutes and to glide. And you definitely can't do either of those things on the moon and Mars.
Yeah. It seems a little bit weird to try. Now the propulsive landing on the moon and Mars, because Mars has gravity, the moon, what's the moon's gravity compared to Earth? It's like tiny,
one-sixth.
Right?
It's 1/6. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, cause you're, like the software, the algorithm that figures out that propulsive landing is going to be just slightly different, right, than on Earth, right?
I mean, it will need its own dedicated.
Yeah, like you're not just going to assume, oh, it'll figure it out, right? Like you're going to run those through calculations and figure and do all that, but you already have the framework for doing it.
Absolutely.
In probably the most difficult place you're ever going to land. I mean, where else would we put a Starship? Europa.
I mean, eventually someday, yeah, maybe out, you know, I mean, yeah, like
we're not going Enceladus. To Mercury or Venus. There's no point, and that'd be terrible. Mars,
Enceladus, and the, Europa are maybe potential candidates,
right?
In a very distant future.
Yeah, and none of the other gas giants are whatever. So yeah, I mean, yeah. So if you've already got it, like probably the hardest version of that system of landing, then. Yeah, why wouldn't you just use that again? It seems like it makes more sense to do it than to not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. What else do we have in the news this week? There's space.
Well,
sorry, I had a big old
fat.
We need
more space stuff.
Well, did
we have some catching up to do.
Is Starship, or no, I'm sorry. What's the Star
Starliner?
Liner? Yeah, yep. Sorry. Is that going, that's not going out of Kennedy Space Center, is it?
It's going out of Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, which is right out there on the Cape. So right next door to Kennedy Space Center. So you'd go to the, you might go to the Kennedy Space Center visitor complex, you know, if you're going to watch that launch.
And if you
Why,
were
is
there
anything?
You might see a Model Y because apparently the Tesla Model Y has been spotted at Kennedy Space. Do you call it KSC? Do space people call this what's the like shorthand?
Yeah, KSC.
Okay. And that's not Kansas City. So
no, that's Casey.
Casey, see, I'm not. I don't even. Yeah. Okay.
Casey and JoJo.
Kentucky Space Chicken.
Yeah, obviously.
Oh, yes, that's what we need. I love how this is just some random dude in a parking lot taking these photos. Apparently, the Tesla Model Y has been making its way around these United States, and it has been banged up a little bit. So we got some photos here. It looks like there's some damage ish.
Wow.
You kind of see that on the side there. I think on the they have a closer up photo.
Missing its hubcaps.
Well, okay. So don't know what. Yeah. Anyways. And this one has these. If you guys remember from the Model 3 unveiling, not the handover event, but the original unveiling, it had these same wheels. These were the Sonic turbine wheels, I believe they called them. And they never got released. This isn't like something you can buy. So they're on this car. They're running around. You know, $10 says it's literally the same wheels you saw on that prototype Model 3 at the unveiling. And they're like, what are we going to put on this? I don't know. Just grab those ones, whatever. But Model Y is making its way around. We've got more looks at it. Maybe they were going there to see the launch or just have one, Dippin' Dots or whatever you get at Kennedy Space Center. you know,
ice cream of the future.
Yeah, and you can get some a hot dog or something. Whatever it is. So Model Y sightings, super cool. I am very excited about getting mine next year. And I'm still not as optimistic as a lot of people, though. A lot of people are saying that we're going to see these in Q1, My guess is we really won't see any customer deliveries until Q2 of next year. So, you know, more to
I can come. See at the I can see at the end of the quarter doing some, you know, low run push.
Yeah.
Just be like, look, we took deliveries. We delivered ahead of schedule just to, you know, make just the headlines or whatever. It, yeah.
yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, probably like they did the Model 3. There was like 30 of them for yeah. know, the top investors or whatever, that kind of a thing.
Poor people that got cars that were like handmade via...
Basically, yeah. I mean, that's the yeah. thing with the Roadster too. From my understanding, the Roadster is like still just like barely a twinkle in Tesla's eye in terms of making the thing. But, you know, with such a low volume, yeah, you could almost make those by hand. You know, I mean, Ferrari and those guys, that's how they do it. So,
right.
So, Model Y sightings, good stuff.
Speaking of Roadster, why have we heard nothing about it and hardly seen it since 2017?
You haven't seen this guy here?
I mean, that's great, but it's not quite big enough for most of us.
Well, I think Elon said, you know, Elon talked about it a little bit, that making the Roadster is not and was not critical for Tesla's success. It wasn't the priority. It probably still isn't the priority for the majority. This is my speculation. But, you know, if you think about what's important for Tesla, the Model 3 was obviously critically important, right? Without the Model 3, the company would have, well, I don't think the company would have died. But, like, doing the Model 3 and not being successful at that effort, we would no longer have Tesla. So that was it. Then now there's a gazillion other products that are coming out. The solar stuff, the power walls are big, taking a lot of, you know, time and attention away. And now the Model Y. So the Model Y is, I think, the next biggest focus for their kind of manufacturing systems and the people that, you know, design and build those things. So, yeah, I just don't think the Roadster is still, it's just not a priority yet, I don't believe. I think it was a marketing thing, and it certainly did its job. I mean, that, in my experience, and I've been to a lot of these events in the past few years, was still the best event that they've ever had, was the Roadster semi event. I think, again, you know, with semi as well, they could probably kind of build those by hand or like have a very small manufacturing facility that like maybe we don't even know about yet. I think like there's ways to, because they're so low volume, you know, like 5,000 of those is maybe a lot. To sell in a year, kind of a thing. I think if you look at semi trucks, I think when I looked at it, in the U.S., there's like 100,000 sold total every year. So you know, you don't really need a giant facility to make a bazillion of those because you're not going to sell them. Even if you took a huge market share, it's still not a lot of cars or a lot of vehicles. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Yeah, I obviously am the most interested in the Roadster, but am not holding my breath at all, because I just don't know. I'm guessing 2-3 years we'll maybe hear something about it. Yeah, maybe next year we'll hear some murmurings, but 2021, 2022, that's when I expect it'll actually show up. Yeah.
Sweet.
And on that note, you know, the Roadster is going to need places to charge. And thankfully, EVgo is now partnering with Tesla on charging. Or other way around, whatever. They are partnering together. EVgo, if you're unfamiliar, makes fast charging systems, you know, chargers and all that. They're, besides Electrify America, they're probably the next biggest one. And a lot of, if you, you know, anyone listening owns a Nissan Leaf or a Chevy Bolt or any of those things, you probably are very familiar with this, because they were giving away 1 to 2 years, depending on, you know, the deal you got, 1 to 2 years of charging at these stations. And they use different adapters and things. So, you know, the common adapters out there, the level 2 chargers, which is like, you know, faster than maybe than your house, obviously. But, you know, common is a J1772. So if you ever hit a charge point station or Blink or even Clipper Creek EV charger you can install at your home, that's the standard there. Then the fast charging either uses something called CHAdeMO, which I believe is a Japanese standard, or CCS, which is really popular in Europe. And Tesla has adopted the CCS charging system in Europe. So if you buy a Model 3 over there, it'll actually have that plug.
They had to, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, otherwise it would just be it would be bad. But in addition to that, EVgo now, in their partnership with Tesla, is going to start installing fast chargers with Tesla plugs, which is their proprietary one.
Cool.
You can buy an adapter for a CHAdeMO to Tesla plug, and I believe there's probably one for CCS as well, but those things are kind of pricey, and it's still kind of spotty and questionable whether or not. And if you're here in the U.S. and you're doing it, you probably don't care because you're using the Tesla Supercharger network anyways. But for other places where EVgo is more popular, you know, the more the merrier, essentially. Couple quotes here. This is from EVgo. EVgo's new program features integrated Tesla connectors installed at all EVgo public fast charging stations in the city of San Francisco in California. We expect the program to expand nationally from there in 2020. EVgo's new integrated Tesla charging provides up to 90 miles of charge in about 30 minutes at one flat per minute rate with no additional fees. So if you guys have never used things that aren't Tesla chargers, this is actually kind of cool that they have a flat rate, because what you see a lot of is just all kinds of weird fees and stuff and demand charges. And it's what essentially those companies are getting charged. Like, for example, if you want to use the Electrify America 350 kilowatt charger, you're going to pay a lot, because what happens is once you get above a certain rate of charge, so a certain charge speed, they are, you know, Electrify America are being charged, you know, an exponentially higher rate from the utility company, because they are drawing such a high amount of power at that time. So the fact that they're going to have a flat rate is really nice. And in San Francisco, very busy city, very crowded, you know, there's going to be, I think that'll actually be kind of cool.
Yeah, there's an EVgo, I don't want to call it a station, there's just one unit there, charging unit, but yeah. Over by the coffee shop that I go to all the time. And I've never used it because it's like 2 miles that way and my house is right here. But I was thinking about doing a video on my second channel where I just try it.
Yeah.
Just see how it works, because I've never used anything outside of a Tesla charger.
You would go back to not using it very quickly, I imagine. The experience isn't great, I'll say that.
Well, I just wanted to see what that was, though, and kind of document it and share it with people, because, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
Will it show up? It won't show up on, like, Tesla's maps yet, will it? Was that part of the partnership? Because that'd be slick if they had the option to, like, when you're navigating, at least show you those options too, or a way to filter through those.
Yeah, I didn't see that. They certainly could do that. It's not, you know, something that's incredibly difficult to do. They do have 750 fast charging stations, which by the way, fast charging is such a like, I just hate that. This is your Business Insider moment. It's like, when you're looking out there, people will call DC fast charging 24 kilowatts. That's terrible. That's not slow compared to, say, a regular outlet from your house. But
it's not much better.
But on the, you know, if that's the low end of fast charging, on the high end, you're at 350 kilowatts. Like, you're not even in the same ballpark. You know what I mean? That's 0 to 60 in 12 seconds or 0 to 60 in 3 seconds. These are not the same thing, right?
Right.
So I hate that, but they do exist. It does essentially increase Tesla's, you know, compatibility with fast charging. They already, you know, have adapters for all the standard public chargers, which aren't very popular amongst Tesla owners because you have to pay for them compared to Tesla destination chargers. But, you know, the more the merrier. The thing I'm excited about is that Tesla is actually partnering with someone else when it comes to charging. Maybe.
Yeah, I was about to say, nobody else has done that before, right?
Right. It's not the partnership that we want. What we want is Rivian to support the supercharger network. What we want is the, you know, those guys to work with superchargers, not the other way around. But
do we, though? Wait. Do we? Because the supercharger network's already slammed.
It varies.
Look at West Coast. I mean, you can barely, like, there's times you're waiting hours just to start charging. Do we want more cars on that same network, or do we want our cars to have more options?
Well, it depends. Are you a nationalist or a populist? Like which which side of the spectrum are you on? Like, because if you're, say, you know, screw everyone that's not Tesla, yeah, don't do that and give me more options. But if you're like, hey, let's have all EVs be better and, you know, more people buying different kinds of EVs overall, then you want them to work with Tesla. So
you're saying you don't necessarily, you're saying like it'd be great if Rivian had accepted the, adopted the supercharger standard, not necessarily saying, hey, we're just going to piggyback and no, only use your superchargers.
No, no, no. I'm saying Ford and Porsche and Rivian and everyone coming out with really, like, you know, good EVs, that they should do everything they can to try to work with Tesla to use their supercharger network, because otherwise people are going to have a real hard time buying these cars. Especially Rivian is the one that sticks out to me the most, because Ford, I get it, right? Ford sells and has more money. Like, they could build their own supercharger network if they wanted to. They have that much money, right? And they're dumping money into EVs. So Ford, and because they have a heritage there of, like, we're Ford and, you know, we've built the auto industry in this country, I could see them wanting to protect that. I could see them not wanting to see a Ford, whatever, add a supercharger. That'd be, like, kind of hurt so their brand a little bit. So I get that. Rivian, no. You're a brand new company. You're a startup. You got no heritage. You got nothing to lose here. Everything to gain. I don't know what the story is behind it. I imagine they approached them, but I would really hope that they would want to work on the Tesla Supercharger Network, especially a company like them who really advertises this adventure lifestyle, like go anywhere kind of thing. That only works if you have good fast charging network to support you. And despite them getting, you know, what, a couple $1 billion in funding, that's still barely enough to, like, do your plant and make your cars. You know, that's not enough to also build out a ginormous fast charging network. So I would just imagine if you're a startup in the EV space that you should really, really want that.
There's so many other, there's, again, EVgo, Electrify America, you know, all the ChargePoint, all these other, you know, companies that are all working on getting their networks up and running.
Yeah.
That if Rivian, say, all of a sudden was like, hey, Tesla only, there could be a chance that in two or 3 years, a supercharger will. Okay. I was going to say, because then superchargers might not be the most popular thing either, you know?
No, it's going to take, I mean, possibly some of these other guys can try to catch them, but Tesla is so, like, if you look, it's funny because some of these guys, Electrify America comes out, or, you know, stands out as, if you look at their coverage, we got a visitor.
We got a guest on the show.
Leaving me alone. Sorry, guys.
All good. Electrify America, if you look at their map, their coverage map, it looks like a supercharger network. You're like, wow, that's amazing. But then you look at how many stalls they have at these locations, and of those stalls, how many are actually fast charging, and you see where Tesla has 40, they'll have 3. And you're right. Covered. You're like, okay, like you have one there, but what if one of those isn't working? What if whatever? You're hosed, you know? I think everyone's working on it. Tesla is light years ahead. And
everyone's working on it. Tesla had worked on it for the past 7 years.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think they should support as many as they can, and Tesla should absolutely be the one that everyone wants to work with. It'd be like if Verizon had 5G and everyone else had 3G, and it's like, oh, sorry, yeah, we don't need that 5G. Like, you do. You really do, because otherwise it's gonna suck, right? So for the health of the EV industry, I think they all should be trying to do that.
Well, don't you think eventually the format wars are going to end and there's going to be one standard that everybody uses?
You know,
I mean, don't you think eventually it has to go that way?
It's really not far off. I mean, the plug isn't necessarily the hard part, and there are adapters already for all the different things. Yeah. So the hard part is more on the software side. So first off, let's say you hit a supercharger that has 250 kilowatts. That is a tremendous speed of electricity just jamming it into your car. Your car, let's say it's a Nissan Leaf, which I don't believe has any thermal management, could just get completely fried if it accepted that whole charge. It would just kill your car. So your car itself has to have the technology in order to handle these things. And then on top of it, when you plug in, what happens is there's not just electricity going through, there's also information. This is how Tesla can charge you for your stop. So there has to be some interface there with, say, a Ford or a Porsche or whoever's using the network. So not only do they have to have, you know, the physical infrastructure or the physical adapters and things, they also have to have the software side of it. So it's a lot, right? But it just definitely seems like something everyone should be trying to do. And, you know, yeah, Ford and Lincoln, I think, have their own wannabe supercharger things. But they, you know, yeah.
You can go to the dealership and charge up.
Yeah, but it
just where I want to go. Hey, can we sell you a new, do you want some popcorn? Would you like a soda? Yeah. Here's our new 2021 Mustang.
We're losing all this money on maintenance. We're going to have to make up for it by charging people for charging.
Yeah. So, but anyways, the future is bright, and I'm excited about Tesla partnering with EVgo and hopefully opening it up to other people and just EV charging in general becoming, you know, more robust than it already is.
Yeah.
And with that, Tesla stock is also on the up and up. Let's see where it's at right now.
Yes, it is.
At this moment, it is at $403.26 per share.
That's crazy.
Which is up 10 points, 2.5% on the day. You know, we'll see how the day ends. It's coming to a close here. I read that this is actually an all-time high for their stock, which is really cool. So for all the people that have been holding onto that stock for a while, you're probably feeling pretty good about it. Now, the interesting thing, I think, if you kind of just expand out, and we're looking at charts here, if you guys are just listening, I'll try to describe that. If you go back 5 days, you can see it's up, you know, 5 days ago it was at around 360, so to 403, pretty good. Going back at the month, you can see there was a big dip coming in, and then it's, you know, up a lot. 6 months, you can see this just ginormous trend where 6 months ago is at 219 a share. So that's a huge jump from that.
Wow.
And you can see, when was this? October. This was must have been right around when earnings came out. Because in October
that
is when
you went
from...
That was the quarter that they had that surprise profit, basically.
Yeah.
And said that Model Y was ahead and that Gigafactory 3 or whatever was like churning cars already. That was,
Yep. So you went from 250... to 330 in a day, right, or 2 days or something. Year to date, though, it's a bit more interesting of a story because if you recall, right before the production numbers and stuff came out for Q4, they were right around 347, and then bam, next 2 days later, 287, and pretty much all year, it was just on a decline until June. So I guess the first half of the year. And then since June, it's kind of been, trending upwards, but definitely like up and down. So, yeah, so the stock's doing well. They're closing in at $420 million, or $420 as the short sellers suffer about a $2 billion loss in this, which is kind of nuts. In fact, I think one of the guys, I think his name was David Einhorn. Maybe that's, I hope that's correct. If not, David, I'm sorry if I got your name wrong. But he was a billionaire and is no longer a billionaire because he's been shorting Tesla stock. So it was a funny tweet. It said, the first guy to become a millionaire by shorting Tesla stock.
he's no longer in the three commas club or the
tres comas.
Yeah, so
I love it.
So good news for people that are stock investors and own Tesla stock,
or just good news for Tesla.
Wasn't 420 supposed to be when they went private?
Yes. The most expensive tweet ever sent.
Yeah.
If I were
just saying, they're getting there.
If I were him, I would probably like print that out and put it on a wall with like a check, like a copy of the check of like $20 million to the SEC for that one. That'd be a cool piece of art.
And no longer ahead of the board of the directors.
Yeah. That's probably, I mean, I don't know. I guess that sucks, but that's probably less important than being CEO, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about this week?
I was just going to add, if they did hit 420 and he did take it private still, I would be thrilled. I would be overjoyed if he was able to pull that off. That would be tremendous, I think, for the future of the company. Although,
yeah,
we'd have less data and information about what's going on with them, right?
It's true.
So it's true. I do like the earnings calls to give us a sense of how they're doing, and they would no longer be obligated to do any of that. So, you know,
the inside glimpses of their finances and handlings but wouldn't be very good.
I think, though, the narrative or the news around them would be much more substantive, with the exception of Business Insider, of course. But, like, think about SpaceX, right? Like, we don't hear necessarily, like, how much money they're, like, what their profits and things are. And we kind of don't care. Like, they're making money. They're killing it. Let's talk about some rockets, right? Like, let's not get into these dumb conversations about how your management structure is. Like, nobody really cares about that except people that want to, in a very short-sighted way, make money on them going up or down. So, like, I would really enjoy just, like, setting aside all of those conversations for, like, pointless. Let's talk about some really dope EVs coming out or some really cool solar stuff. Like, focus on the products, because I think to most people, that's really what is interesting and matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sweet. Well, speaking of interesting and matters, what are you guys working on? Anything interesting or that matters?
No.
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 I got nothing.
What about you, Joe? What are you working on?
I'm working on bumming people out.
Well, yeah.
It is your superpower.
Doom.
That is just what I do.
Doom with Joe.
So I wanted to end the year with a couple of videos. So this is actually a two-parter, sort of. But the first part is things that I'm concerned about for the future as we cross 2020, right? And the other one, the last one of the year, is going to be things that I'm excited about for the future. So reasons why I'm concerned about the future and reasons why I'm optimistic. So it's like two different videos, but I'm starting with the concern one. And yeah, I don't know. We'll see how it does. It's much more of a more of a vlog style kind of thing, I guess. It's not so much like deep dive into one thing. It's just kind of like, here's all the things that are happening right now, and I don't know where they're going, and I don't like it. And I got really into earlier this year, I know this is a really weird, nerdy thing, but you know what? My wife and I, we went to Greece. We took a trip over there and got to see that whole thing, and you know, was interested in that whole time period and everything. Well, I got really into the Bronze Age collapse, which happened around the year 1177 BC. That's kind of like the year that they all kind of default to. But basically, there's like a dozen or so major Bronze Age civilizations around the Mediterranean that all collapsed at the exact same time. And there's been all these theories about why over the years and stuff. And anyway, I read this book that really kind of broke it all down and said it was more like a perfect storm of things that that happened at the same time. And I'm looking at that and I'm looking at today and it's like, oh, there's a lot of parallels that are not making me feel very good. It's all about how civilization might collapse in the near future.
Yay.
Yay.
Tuck the kids in bed, give them a kiss.
Buy Bitcoin.
That kind of thing. Yeah. So, fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, you always do a good job with those, though, with kind of just...
This is a little bit different, so it might suck. But, we'll see. I don't know.
All right. Well, what about you, Mr. Ben?
I posted a tweet about this, but basically I had this what I thought was a really interesting thing that I published this week, and I was like, yeah, I'm really excited about this video and the numbers. I'm like, wow, this is really interesting. And the YouTube algorithm's like, Cybertruck. And I'm like, no, but it's really a Cybertruck. And I'm like, so it's Cybertruck. Next week is a Cybertruck video, and it's about why the towing capacity of Cybertruck and whether or not it's good at towing things is complete and utter vanity metrics and pointless discussions that we just don't even need to have. And the short of it is because people don't use trucks for trucks. They use they're like, and there's this massive study I found that talked about it. And I'm like, oh, fantastic. Yeah. There's real data here. It's not just me like, hey, I called my dad. He said he doesn't tow anything. See? Right? It's like there's real data behind this. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Cool.
Yeah, that'll be a good one.
And what about you?
Do you want to know why it doesn't have an escape system? The Cybertruck.
An escape? You mean if you get locked in the vault?
Ooh. Well. Ejection pod?
Well, there is.
Ejection vault.
There was actually a really great question about whether or not you can fold down, like, not just the window, but, like, the back of the, like, the seats almost.
The middle row access, yeah.
The back of the cab. And then that whole thing just becomes one armored vehicle. And so you could, like, camp in there or, you know, whatever. I think that'd be... I mean, who knows what it's going to be
like. Well, he talked about it a little bit. He said it would likely have HVAC.
In the back.
You know, climate controlled in the back and partial access. You'd imagine it can't have full access because that bed, you know, the bed cover thing rolls right there. So maybe below that or something, there'd be a little tipping thing that would allow you to, you know, slide wood or something through that something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And I wonder how that works with, there's some laws here in the U.S. about... there has to be like an escape button, essentially.
Right.
And this is the most hilarious thing ever is the Bugatti Chiron, a $3 million supercar, has this $10 IKEA metal bracket in the frunk because they didn't want to have to put a light and button escape button. So they separated it into two compartments technically. And it's like two little screws you just take out when you get the car.
Yep.
Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm finished. So I finished that Starship Abort video. Ended up being a 47 or 48 minute long video.
That's good.
Thank you. And then I posted that Peter Beck interview right before we went on air. So the Peter Beck interview from last week is up. And then I'm trying to get out still the pollution video, finish the research on it. So I actually paid someone to really crunch a bunch of numbers for me because I just was finding myself coming up short on a lot of the actual data. So I paid someone to actually like literally write up a whole research paper for me basically, and I'm turning that into my script.
Yeah.
I'm about halfway done with that. So hopefully I'll be able to try to squeeze that out this year. Although remember I was trying to get it out before Team Trees was hit 20 million as like a push. I refreshed during the show. They're at 19,978,619. Wow. So in other words, it'll be over today probably or tomorrow. And yeah, just already I refreshed 19,981,000. I mean, I'm going to be too late. I missed it.
Yeah.
I missed Team Trees. I still want to get it before January 1st and just be like, I'm late to the game. Sorry, it just took me this long to research it, though.
Any donations you get, though, still go to planting trees. It's not just about that number, right?
Exactly. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
So I'll maybe just make fun of myself at the end and be like, sorry, it always takes me so long to make videos.
You're all about the stretch goal.
Yeah. I'm just here to make sure that it's not just a fad of 20 million by 2020, but that it's like 21 million by 2020 or whatever. I don't know.
Isn't that? And did you see Mark Rober's getting a Discovery show or something?
Really?
There was something, a video he posted or talked about something on Discovery. I think it was about them getting a show. And I looked at him thinking, that's kind of going backwards, right? Like, dude, you are like the number one guy right now,
dude.
Why?
No way.
Why would you?
His audience, he'll see less traction from that, literally. And there's no way they're gonna pay him more than he could make on YouTube.
His videos get an average of 27 million views.
Oh my god!
If you do the basic math of, let's say, I forget what the ad rates are, and he's probably getting even better ad rates. I mean, he's making a couple hundred grand per video,
yeah.
Right? Not to mention sponsors and all. I mean, like what?
What could
and you have absolute creative control and freedom over the entire thing.
He'll do that and then go, not doing that again. I guarantee it.
Well, devil's advocate, it might give him more leverage for book deals and speaking engagements and stuff like that. He might be able to charge more money for that kind of thing.
Because he has a... I don't know, man. Because
it's that sort of legacy, prestige thing.
It's the book thing
it's
is
perceived.
A good one.
It's perceived. Yeah, but it's still
prevalent. It's fading.
Yeah.
Because I love when someone's like, oh, they have a show on Discovery Channel. Like, yeah, do you watch Discovery Channel? Yeah. Oh, no, but that's cool.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Oh, I haven't watched that in years.
Yeah. Oh, that's still around? Well, oh, that's awesome, though. Good for them.
When people ask me what I do, I say I have a show on YouTube.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah. So it's like, I don't say YouTuber.
No.
YouTube's just the platform, you know, for what we do. It's not. There are YouTubers. There are people that just vlog. I would say that's a YouTuber.
But I told you my neighbor, right? He was like 9 or 10. And he was like, yeah, so they were over, whatever. And he's like, yeah, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I make videos on YouTube. He's like, what? You're a YouTuber? What do you? Oh, like, you know, he was all super jazzed. And I'm like, yeah, I have the show about economics and electric cars and whatever. He's like, oh, I thought you were, I thought you were a real YouTuber. Oh. And I was like,
the guys that just, all they do is they run around showing off their like Bugattis or whatever.
I mean, if I had a Bugatti, I'd be doing that too.
Well, when you get your two Teslas, like your Roadsters, you can, again, race them or something, and that can be your new channel.
Trade them in for a half of a Bugatti.
It can be called Too Many Teslas. That can be your new channel.
Yeah.
Oh, all right, guys.
We did
Let's get out of here. We did it. Well.
Well, to anybody watching, if you're celebrating Christmas, we will be having that before we see you again. So Merry Christmas to those.
Yeah.
Christmas.
Yeah, we will not be doing a show next week. So don't scream at us on Twitter that we're not around.
First I heard.
Wives and families too.
Oh, well, yeah, that's going to do it for us, guys.
Okay.
We'll see you in our
ludicrous future.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. If you like what we do and you want to kind of help get it out there, you can give us a nice review on any of your podcast streaming platforms, whichever one you use. That kind of helps get it out there. Also, we do have a Patreon set up, so you can join us there at patreon.com/ourludicrousfuture. You can get your name in the credits, meet a whole other group of like-minded people. It's a lot of fun. We do appreciate it. We'll see you there. Thanks.